Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 135 of Strictly Confidential. My name is Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. Stop by Coal River Mountain Watch and have a look and see what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, April 24th, 2008. So, indeed, if you are listening on a Thursday evening, April 24, 08, shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you are more than welcome to call in and participate with myself and with the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia, 304-658-3333. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests and to the audio archives from past shows, as well as our chat room, which is active as I speak, and a good evening to stop by. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com to the main Head On Radio Network main site. You can find out about all of the other progressive programming on this network, of which I'm only a small part. There are links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. And welcome to a Thursday evening edition of Strictly Confidential. Tonight is a music night. We have an amazing man brought to us by our Director of Music Talent, Mr. Glenn Rivera. Glenn doesn't know of his title. He was just awarded it. Glenn, that's the title. You are now officially the Director of Music Talent. Welcome aboard. And thank you for bringing so many talented artists to this show. This evening's guest is Manny Parrish. He's more commonly known as Man Parrish. Man is considered to be a pioneer of electronic music in the hip-hop genres. And he, along with artists such as Kraftwerk, Art of Noise, Afrika Bambaataa, helped create and define the sound of hip-hop in the early 80s. He was an underground music scene icon in the 80s and 90s and is one of the most important and influential figures in American electronic dance music. He is a native New Yorker, and Man Parrish was a member of an extended family unit that converged nightly on Studio 54. His nickname, Man, first appeared in Andy Warhol's Interview magazine. His live shows at Bronx hip-hop clubs were spectacles of light and glitter and pyrotechnics. The form of early hip-hop music he pioneered dominated the post-disco pre-house music scene in the early 80s and was instrumental in the structure of both house and techno music. The New York Times writes, as a gay man, he defies stereotypes set by current hip-hop culture. His release of Hip Hop Bebop Don't Stop was released in 1983, and it is still considered a classic in the genre of electronic music. The album went on to sell over 2 million copies worldwide. He was signed on with Elektra Records and managed by David Bowie's manager. Man Parrish recorded and remixed tracks for Michael Jackson and Boy George and Gloria Gaynor. He served as manager for the Village People and Crystal Water, to name just two. Man continues to record from his Brooklyn studio and is a frequent DJ at New York's eclectic night spots and S&M clubs. His Sunday underground party at the Cock Bar on New York's Lower East Side is notorious, to say the least. I also understand that Man is DJing at the Bad Boy Club, where he is running a system that claims 10,000 watts of power. Wow. He is the main DJ and co-founder for a circuit party called Hustler Ball, which has parties in many cities, and they're worldwide. He also has several adult websites and online businesses that keep him busy as a webmaster. And so, we welcome to the show Mr. Man Parrish. Man, welcome to the show.
How are you?
I'm doing great this evening. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. I'm going, wait, who is he talking about? Is that me?
Yes, sir, I'm afraid.
Yeah, thank you for a wonderful intro. I want to say
you're very welcome.
Me on the show. I do listen to it, and I love it. I think you've got a great show going on. And
well, thank you.
Hello to all the DJs out there that are keeping dance music alive. And I guess before we get started, I do want to say a thank you to Glenn Rivera, who's been wonderful at pulling this together and been, I guess, a little bit of a staple there for you.
Yes, Glenn has very much become indispensable. Indispensable in terms of finding music talent for us. Glenn is doing a wonderful job. I couldn't be happier that Glenn is working with the show in that capacity. It doesn't get any better than Glenn.
He's an angel and needs a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yes, he does. Great guy. Man, I have to ask you, how did this start? Did you come from a musical family? What is the story of the early Manny?
I didn't come from, I had piano lessons when I was a kid. I think I took two of them. The piano teacher hit me over the knuckles with a ruler, and I swore I'd never touch a keyboard again. As I grew up a little later on in life, and that was in the 70s, I'm actually turning 50 in a few days, the big crisis moment. But I grew up with rock and roll bands like, you know, David Bowie, Pink Floyd, all the kind of stuff of my era. And, of course, with that came, you know, the whole free love and drugs and sex and rock and roll. So I was attracted to music. I couldn't find music that I really liked. I built myself a small synthesizer. In that day, it was a Radio Shack thing that just made a couple of bleeps and blurps and, you know, wound up getting high, smoking a joint and playing my own music. But I was always attracted to esoteric kind of music like John Cage. There was a synthesizer group called Tonto's Expanding Headband back in the 70s and stuff like that. A very early Kraftwerk. I didn't know at the time they were Kraftwerk, but those experimental kind of sound, avant-garde, it would be called ambient music today. So I kind of came, I learned music through experimenting. I can't read or write. I can't, if you tell me to play a G7 chord, I'll look at you like you're crazy. But if you say that, I'll go, oh, yeah, I know what that is, and I'll be able to. I'm ear-trained, not book-trained.
I see. Well, apparently. Well, that's actually a gift that you're able to do it that way. So many people are forced to learn it. To some, it just comes natural. You're talking about synthesizers. I understand in the early years you were good friends with a Roland 808.
Yeah, well, I go back even before the Roland 808. I go back to pre-MIDI, which is Musical Instrument Digital Interface. It's a language that synthesizers talk to each other in computers. And I go back before 808s and before MIDI when we had synthesizers with patch cords. If you ever listen to any of the Tomita albums or the old Wendy Carlos Switched on Bach, she used to have those on the front cover, those panels with knobs and patch cords. I had similar setups like that. And you'd have to, there were no push buttons. You couldn't dial up a string sound. You would push a button and get a string sound. You'd have to actually dial it in and actually create sounds from scratch using oscillators and filters and envelope followers and stuff like that. The 808 came a little bit later. I remember being in a cab, and I lived in Manhattan at the time, and the cab driver had a progressive rock and roll station on, and they played a Kraftwerk track, Autobahn. And we got to my in front of my house, and this was the first time it was played on the radio, I guess, in New York, one of the few first times. And we both sat there. He shut the meter off, and I'd said, what is it, a 10-minute track or something like that? And we just sat there totally stunned because back in the day, you didn't hear anything like that on the radio. It was either rock and roll or funk or country, maybe some dance music starting to happen, but certainly not on the radio. So I became fascinated by this, you know, what's this new sound? How do they do that? How do they make it? Went out to a couple of music stores, you know, like, you know that group Kraftwerk? And they said, oh, they use these drum machines. So before the 808 classic drum machine, club sound drum machine came out, there were some early ones like CompuRhythm and Boss Rhythm that people would have bossa nova beats and kind of practice their guitar licks and their bass lines too. So I started with those very early drum machines and grew up later to finally have one that I could actually program instead of being stuck with the samba and the bossa nova beat. You know, I was really making records when the 808 started to happen, which was a god.
Well, man, in looking at the information regarding the 808, I see that it is still highly sought after. It, in fact, sells for more now than it did back in the day because of its sound. Apparently, it was thought of as a lesser than because it was more economically priced. But these days, people are desperately trying to find them. Did you know that?
Well, I have a funny story. I purchased my 808 for $300 or $400 when it first came out, and last year, I mean, I sold it over the years and used samples. 808 samples, and some purist people, I don't get into it, but some people say it's not the same as the actual machine. The machines have little quirks in them that kind of just, you know, they sound a little bit more real. It's a synthetic sound, how could it be real? But you know what I'm saying, a sample could be very static. And I wound up purchasing mine on eBay for $1,600. So I bought it for four, sold it for $700 or $800, and had to pay $1,400. You know, to get an 808 back into my life.
You know for a fact then, yes, those are sought after. Now, you mentioned Switched on Bach, which I'm fascinated that you did. I had that album many hundreds
album.
Of years
ago. Wendy Carlos had that. Did that. I didn't do that, but I used to listen to that because...
I did, too.
You know, we would sit there and, you know, and... put a bong in front of my face and not breathe any oxygen until I passed out. But we would listen to Pink Floyd and Turned On music, trippy head music, you know, in those days it was called the end of the psychedelic culture, you know, in the mid to late 70s. You know, I'm talking about 74, 75, 76. I was very young. I left home at a very, 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 very early age. I was 14 years old when I left home. My mom had Alzheimer's disease. We didn't know what it was at the time, just except for that she's crazy, get out, and managed to kind of survive in the streets. And as a gay man, I had, you know, 14 years old, how do you have a boyfriend? I mean, he was 18. And he worked at the Continental Bath. And I went down there, and I saw Bette Midler and Barry Manilow when she was nobody. And she, you know, the classic famous, her playing at the Continental with the towel and... with Barry Manilow as her piano player, you know. So I was there for way back then, with songs that were just coming out, like Soul Mucosa and Rock the Boat, when they were first stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, it's good that you remember the good things. Being out in New York at 14 years old had to be a tough experience, yet you managed to save some good memories of seeing Bette Midler.
But things were a little bit different then. Things were a lot looser. At 14, I used to go to clubs, or 16, you know, for instance, Continental Bath. In those days, nobody asked you for ID, nobody asked you for proof. You know, I smoked cigarettes at 15, 16. You could buy a pack of cigarettes, no one asked for your ID. They just either just assumed you were old enough. I was a tall, big guy, you know, so I always looked a lot older than my age. But, you know, they probably figured I'm probably old enough to do it, and if not, hey, it's just a kid who's smoking cigarettes, you know what I mean? So nobody said anything, so clubs, work situations and things like that were a lot different. You know, I had a job at CBS Records in the mail room, and I think I stole more records than I actually delivered up to the floors because I was fascinated by records and music, you know. They say this is a hot record and it's got to go up to the 23rd floor, and it, you know, it's so and so's you know, latest release. You know, it's a Billy Joel release or whoever it was at the time. And I'd say okay, and I'd go in the hallway and put it in my bag to go home and listen to it and study it. You know,
so
and I,
was
of course
this
I dropped
the...
it off. I gave it to the receptionist, you know. And,
right. So is this the job you had in your later teenage years that when you first bought the Radio Shack synthesizer and began experimenting?
Yeah. I mean, I hung out with, back then when I bought the little Radio Shack, dude, I'm 15, 16 years old, and smoking pot and, you know, making synthesizer sounds, hanging out at clubs at night, and, you know, I couldn't hold down a job. I was out of my mind. You know, 3 months at 16 years old was a long run in any particular job. Worked in clothing stores and worked at Sam Goody music stores up here in the East Coast of New York. I worked at CBS Records and a couple of other places. I remember working in a men's clothing store, and every time the underwear or the Speedo representative came in, for some reason I was always the guy they asked to go in the back and put on the Speedos, and they'd come out and go, "Oh, look at that. That looks good. So for somebody, you know?
Yeah, it all becomes clear as we look back on it.
Sure does.
Man, someone of your talent.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that someone of your talent and potential must have gotten bored very quickly with the Radio Shack machine. So you moved quickly from that, I would guess.
Yeah. Well, there wasn't a lot available on the market. My first was a Roland SH-101 synthesizer, and it was sort of like a glorified organ. I don't remember whether it was polyphonic or not. The old synthesizer modules weren't, but this may or may not have been. It had a couple of stops on the front, and you'd push these tabs down, and it would say flute or tuba, and it, you know, took a simple oscillator, and it had a filter on it, and it was very basic, nothing controllable, really. You couldn't synchronize it with a drum machine or a tape machine. In those days, I had a 15-inch reel-to-reel tape machine and two giant Oltec Lansing Voice of the Theater speakers, and
wow,
my neighbor's nuts by actually my boyfriend at the time had it, but I'm sure we drove him nuts because, you know, there was probably a black light with a Dayglow poster, you know, glowing out the window, and all these out of space sounds going on out of the house, and the smell of pot, and, you know, they kind of avoided me in the hallway. You know, there's that freak living up there making all those weird sounds, you know.
So you were making this music and recording it to the 15-inch reel-to-reel and
sound on sound. So you would take the left channel, and it wasn't even four-track then. You would take the left channel, bounce it to the right, and you take the right channel and bounce it back to the left, and you would build up layers and layers. And I called them soundscapes. So they weren't rhythmic because I didn't have a drum machine, but they were. It would be ambient sound now, or not quite new age, because it wasn't musical. They were just kind of layers of sounds and waves of sound. So I came from a very experimental background, and I stopped doing, you know, smoking pot when I was like 16, 17, but I actually wound up getting hooked up with a friend of mine. Her name is Cherry Vanilla. She worked with Andy Warhol and all these people going on downtown, and her manager was the guy who gave us pot. And he said, "There's a party going on downtown. Why don't you come down and join the party? Everybody's going to be there." And we're like, "Well, okay, whatever." Walked in, and there was Andy Warhol and all these downtown, you know, celebrities that I had, Candy Darling and all these people that I didn't know who they were. You know, I was 16, 17, 18 years old, and the cast of Sgt. Pepper's that was on Broadway at the time, and it was in a loft, and, you know, I'm sure I didn't drink the punch, but I'm sure it was spiked because that's what you did in those days. It was socially acceptable behavior. And I got involved with this kind of underground group of New York City people, and this is the first time that people that were quote-unquote artists weren't weirdos. They were considered, you know, respectable people. You're not a weirdo because you do music or strange sounds with your synthesizer. You're an artist, or you're experimenting with art. So I found a home amongst these people, you know, for many years in the underground New York City community like that. I was much younger than I should have been in that situation, but by today's standards. But back then, you know, it was commonplace. I had friends like Matt Bowd. I don't know if you knew, they had that TV show on Channel 13, The All American Family, back in the late 70s. He was one of the first reality TV shows, so to speak, on PBS, and he came out on national public television back in the 70s and had to leave his little town of wherever they were in Ohio or something and came to New York. So he was somebody else who was around my age that I became close friends with. But he knew Andy Warhol and all these fabulous people, so we would go to these little parties, and, you know, for me it was free food. I didn't have a job, you know, but I wound up getting into this group of people that I wasn't a freak. I wasn't some weirdo making music. I was an artist, and I was respected by other people. So that's how my musical stuff really kind of solidified and became more of a permanent thing in my life.
I see. Well, did you mention Klaus? I dropped a word on this end.
Sure.
I'm wondering if this is about the period of time that you met. You were influenced by the what you call electronic experiments of a good friend, Klaus and Brian. Is this about the time you met them, began hearing other electronic artists?
Are you talking about Klaus Nomi, or which one?
Yes. Yes, Klaus Nomi and Brian Eno.
Right. Brian Eno, we used to go to the Mud Club in New York, and Brian Eno, I think, was staying above there, and he used to come downstairs and hang out, and there was a lot of experimental music. I was very much into, you know, music for airports and the ambient kind of stuff. It was just so different from everything else. In those days, you were either rock and roll or a disco, all of a sudden there was this new kind, just non-melodic experimental music that was starting to emerge, you know. So I became, kind of aware of this different kind of genre of stuff. And New York City had something called the New Wave Vaudeville Show, and I was working with Lance Loud, and that's just about the time when disco, they had that whole death to disco thing going on. So we thought, what could we do to be outrageous? We took the Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK and did a Giorgio Moroder, Donna Summer version of it, which was like could have started a riot in the right kind of club.
Yes, I should think so.
Yeah, we performed it on stage, and, you know, it was tongue-in-cheek and camp. And I remember going back up to the dressing room and talking to some people, and we heard this opera music. I think, opera? This is New Wave Vaudeville. You know, what's this opera business? And they said, oh, you have to come. You have to see this. There's a guy in a clear plastic raincoat with some makeup on and a smoke machine and a strobe light, and he's literally singing. And I was like, what? So I remember running downstairs and standing in the balcony looking out over the stage, and there was Klaus Nomi singing his operatic stuff, and I was like, that guy's really singing. Afterwards, he came back upstairs, and I said, I just want to tell you, I think that's really cool and great. He goes, yeah, I like your music too. You sound like Giorgio Moroder. I want to be like Donna Summer. Maybe we do some music? And I said, sure, you know. You know, this will be one for the record, you know what I mean? So
we became friends
and did some experimental music. I had a loft in Midtown Manhattan. We hung out with Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf and some of those artist types, and everybody hung out at my house, you know. There were no rules, no boundaries. People would just fall asleep on the floor, you know, bunch of kids in a loft and that kind of stuff. But Klaus would come by and we'd do some music, and as he got more and more attention, he built his band, and then I kind of got involved with doing some tracks with him. And you know, his management wanted him to be rock and roll because in those days electronic music was not commercially available. If they wanted to make any money, they'd have to give him a band and take him on the road. So I became like a studio kind of place for him to experiment. So
I see. Well, we are in fact posting a link to some photographs of Klaus in the chat room, and it may very well be the picture that you're referring to. It looks like a sort of a cone type cylindrical raincoat. For those of you who are not in the chat,
there's a movie called Nomi Song. Nomi Song, and I think it's for rent in some of these places. I'm in the movie as well, and one of the bonus things on the DVD is a track, one of his old tracks that I finally 10-20 years after he died, got to actually remix and probably put it in more in line with what he wanted to do rather than what his rock and roll band and management forced him to do. So,
well, he's quite a character. Netflix, in fact, has that movie available if you're a Netflix subscriber. I didn't realize that you were involved with the movie and actually have sound and even in the movie till this afternoon. I certainly intend to see it. When was that movie released?
About 3 years ago, two or 3 years ago. We filmed it almost 8 or 10 years ago, and it went through a lot of revisions and legal licensing problems and all that kind of stuff. And it was an American living in Berlin, and he finally got the movie put together. It was released about 3 or 4 years ago. If you do get the DVD, there's an additional, like a bonus features section of it where I tell some hysterical stories of meeting Klaus at the infamous Piers in New York, and after shows in those days, with the straight band members and all of us freaks would go out to the invade a bathhouse after doing a show and scare everybody to their, you know, with right. makeup on and perfect hair, running around in towels and stuff like that. So those wonderful little war stories are there.
Yeah. Well, for those of you who would like to see the movie, the full title is The Nomi Song, and that's spelled N-O-M-I. And by the way, man, we are posting links to your sites in the chat room. For those of you who are not in the chat room, you can find out about Man Parrish at www.manparrish.com, and that's Parrish with two R's, manparrish.com.
Yeah, Parrish, yeah.
Yeah, and you can find him over at MySpace, too, by going to myspace.com/officialmanmade. Man, were you
at... Somebody else has Man Parrish. Some kid took Man Parrish and has it as his site as an option.
Uh-huh.
So I guess that's a type of flattery, which is really nice, you know.
Yeah. Well, was Klaus one of the folks you went to Studio 54 with? Was he around during those days?
No, Klaus was a little bit, about the same time, a little bit earlier. Studio 54 opened up, and I was a complete club kid at that point in New York. Now I'm a big old bear-looking kind of guy, I guess, but back then I had purple hair and a skirt and yellow shoes and, you know, probably a clown. Looked like Ronald McDonald, probably, if you look at the picture now. But I was a trendy little club kid, and I used to go to Dance Interior in New York, Haraz, and everybody said there's this club opening at called Studio 54, and it's supposed to be the tell-all of all New York City clubs. And a friend of mine, this girl in my neighborhood, was sleeping with the doorman, and she said, "Oh, I know that club. I can get in anytime I want. I'm sleeping with the doorman." I said, "You're kidding me." She says, "You want to go? I'll take you." We went every Friday and every Saturday for 3 years without fail. Towards the end, a little bit less, but we got in parties where famous people were standing outside and couldn't get in because she knew the doorman. And she wound up being, she was a costume designer, so she would make little matching outfits, and we would show up like the Bobbsey twins in little space outfits and little, plastic pants, you know what I mean, and all kinds of crazy little things that would get us through the door each week. And it was quite an experience. A lot of people think that Studio 54 was a big space, but it was actually a small theater. And you'd stand there and you'd be dancing, and you'd have Mick Jagger, Bianca Jagger, and, Sylvester Stallone and Halston, and, on and on and on through the celebrity list, you know what I mean? And to me, I wasn't into that kind of stuff, so it was just a cool kind of place to hang out. Later on, I think it was in the second year, my roommate, whose name is Joey Arias, who was the lead in Cirque du Soleil's Humanity, worked at a place called Fiorucci in New York. And they were having their 10th anniversary, and my record Hip Hop Bebop was coming out at the time, and they said, "Would you like to headline the show at Studio 54 for their 10th anniversary?" I was like, "Oh my God, yeah, of course." Well, they had somebody else, an unknown girl, singing, and she had a song called Holiday, and her name was Madonna, and she was my opening act.
you. Oh, that's priceless. You've got to go back away.
Yeah, which I have the poster for.
Yeah.
And the day that, a week before we did that show, my mom had passed away, so I went from the grave to Studio 54 to do rehearsal. And I was completely like a vegetable at this point. And they said, do you have a special entrance? Do you want to do anything special? And I said, well, I would really love to come down from the ceiling. So sure enough, they rigged it up and they wired me up and we went to rehearsal once or twice. You know what I mean? And the night of the show, they put down a screen, lifted me up into the rafters of Studio 54. And I remember this little, I'm 6'3", this little guy, must have been 4 or 5 feet tall, said, I'm going to lift you up today. And I went, Jesus Christ, I mean, are you going to hold me? Are you going to drop me to the five story? You know, you're going up 3 or 4 or 5 stories there. And he said, sure, no problem, we counterweight you. He said, but just whatever you do, don't rock back and forth because there's 20,000 volts of neon signs on either side, and you'll electrocute yourself and probably put glass all over the floor. They're more worried about the floor downstairs than me being electrocuted and falling off this little bird perch that they put me on. But
yeah.
It was quite an experience. I wish there was a video from it. I think there's some photos floating around, which I don't have. But
well, speaking of videos, man, I did manage to locate a short video on YouTube, which I posted under your calendar date at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. I believe it's one of the ones in the purple hair time. just so people could see.
That was an art rock band, yeah.
And man, I'm beginning to understand. I'm beginning to understand better. You refer to your to an extended family, and that you converge nightly at Studio 54. And I understand how I'm beginning to understand anyway how you why you would use that phrase when you leave home that early when you're 14. In fact, that really was your family.
Well, here's the difference. Today, in those days, the East Village, Greenwich Village in New York City, for those who didn't live in New York, there's one legend that I'm friends with now, many years later. Her name is Rollerina. And she, like, for instance, she'd be walking down 7th Avenue, Christopher Street in New York, and someone would whiz by you in a fairy godmother outfit with cat's eye glasses and a wand on roller skates, going up into traffic on 7th Avenue and Broadway, and cars would be trying not to hit her, and she'd be blessing all the cars, and people would be laughing, and the cops would chase her, and she'd disappear down some alley and never be seen again, and she would famously appear. So in those days, people were individuals. Some were obviously crazy, but other people were just individuals, and you were considered not so much brave or cool, but everybody, you know, it was more accepted in a sense. So a lot of these people kind of converged in New York City because you couldn't walk around a small town in the Midwest with purple hair without probably getting killed. But in New York, either you were nuts and avoided, or you were respected for some way or another. So in that sense, it was an extended family. You can go into a club, you can go with a party at somebody's house, and you weren't that weirdo. You were like, okay, you're cool, you're accepted. What do you do? I'm interested in knowing what's your life about. And people were more open, more expressive. You know, there wasn't so much of the politically correct kind of stuff going on, you know, which took a lot of the fun out of that. I'm in New York City now, and I've been in the club scene since in the 70s or 80s, and it's drastically, drastically changed. I'm at the Cock Bar in New York on Sundays. I have a party called Sperm, which we could talk about. But today, somebody just put a little tiny piece of graffiti on the door, and the city sent him a letter immediately telling him that if he didn't remove the graffiti, it would be $several thousand worth in fines, or the city will come and remove the graffiti themselves. And the graffiti's maybe, you know, a little 2-foot piece of graffiti. So the politically correctness that's now didn't happen back then. So you had families and you had like-minded people, either sexually oriented or creatively oriented, that kind of were together. You know what I mean?
Well, man, would you say that it was the artist amongst your extended family that allowed you to believe in yourself enough to release something like
that?
Absolutely. Yes,
absolutely, because you weren't out on a limb. You know, as long as you weren't hurting yourself or hurting somebody else, people were supportive. And if I said I wanted to do an experimental music track and try to have some lights or lasers or something kind of cool, people go, wow, that's great. You know, I know a way you can get government funding, you know what I mean? Or there's an artist grant that you can do because I did it. Let me help you. So you weren't, oh, what are you, crazy? You're going to do that? Why don't you get a job, a real job? You know, you didn't get that kind of feedback. You had permission to be yourself and to experiment. I mean, obviously, as long as you weren't hurting anybody or you weren't doing anything destructive. And it's ironic, but people were less destructive then than they were now because so many people are bottled up right now or can't express themselves because of all the politically correct kind of stuff. So they, you know, they tend to party a little too much and do their drugs or their destructive behaviors, where back then, you know, people had outlets. You're frustrated, you can do a piece of art or you could write a song or you can be a performance artist or be an actor or some sort of way to get it out of your system. Now,
Manny, please tell us how you led up to what happened just before and how you came up with the idea of hip-hop bebop, which I understand
Hip-hop bebop was an experimental record with a beat underneath it. Because if you look at the structure of the song, there is no verse, chorus, and bridge. There are no lyrics. There is no real melody. I had an 8-track half-inch tape recorder. Most of the records I did in that day, including the Man to Man record, the Male Stripper record, were done in my house on an 8-track half-inch tape recorder. So the drums were on channel 1, the bass was on channel 2, the vocals would be on channel 3 with maybe a background on 4, leave me 4 more tracks for maybe percussion, a couple of keyboard parts, so on and so on. So Hip Hop Bebop started out as this experimental kind of track with a drum beat, with an 808 drum beat underneath it. And at the same time, I did a soundtrack for a Joe Gage a porno movie, and that came through. I was really literally a starving artist. I was living in an art gallery, and they let me live there. If I swept the floors every day, I had a cot in the back, and I had a hot plate, but there was cold running water. I had to boil water and put a sponge into my armpits and, you know, and take a shower that way, or I'd go home with somebody and say, can I use your shower? kind of situation. So I was really the starving artist, and I wound up I just lost my train of thought for a second. I'm sorry. But Hip Hop Bebop was an experimental thing in the loft that I lived in. And
ma'am, were you surprised at the wide acceptance? I understand that Hip Hop Bebop is now even being used in a PlayStation or?
It's in Grand Theft Auto 1 and 2. it's in Shaun of the Dead movie. They hold it up about a half hour and they say Hip Hop Bebop, greatest record in the world. I didn't ask them to do it. They just did it on their own. I actually had to go out and buy a PlayStation to actually know that it was in there because it was licensed through another company that claims they own it.
In your wildest dreams, man, did you ever think it would come to your music being in a video game?
No. And I was kind of, in those days, I was quote-unquote cutting edge. I had a computer, Radio Shack TRS-80 computer. You know,
that's cutting edge.
Yeah, I could do little squares up maybe the size of, there would be big chunks and clunks on the screen right now, and I would try to do little simple animations. In those days, computers had 16K of memory, maybe 32K of memory, and you would load the program in through a cassette tape recorder. It would take 10 or 15 minutes to load a Pong program. And that relates to one of the music things that I did. I had Giorgio Moroder's MC8 Micro Composer, which in those days you didn't play it into a computer. You typed all the numeric values of the music that you were doing into this hexadecimal keypad. Okay, so the lowest key on the keyboard was 0, and the highest was 127. You'd have to figure out what a C was and a D was and an E and an F.
Stars!
Wait, it gets better than that. You type in a note value, and then you type in a time value. So is it an 8th note, a 16th note, a dotted note? And every bar had to equal 24 of these things. So you'd put in a note value, a trigger value, and a gate value for each note. And I remember
all of it hexadecimal.
I had it plugged in, and I did about 9 hours of work. And my dog came running into my room, jumped up on my lap, pulled the plug out, and everything was gone.
Oh, man.
I had a war with synthesizer programming and stuff like that.
Well, I
picked up from a record label, which a lot of DJs know as Disconet. It was a famous remix a lot of the older DJs out there will remember that. My ex-boyfriend at the time was a editor for a magazine in New York called Mandate, or one of those magazines, and Joe Gage was doing, you know, gay adult films, said, I need somebody to do music. And my friend said, oh, you got to go to Manny Paris. She's got synthesizers and could do all this great sound. It'd be great for a soundtrack. So I didn't see the movie, but Joe said, I need a couple of songs here and there, and I could use a title song about 8 minutes long called Heatstroke. And I said, well, what's the scenario? It's a guy goes downtown, and supposedly he's straight, but winds up with another guy. I said, okay, let me see what I could do. We wind up doing it. He puts it in the movie. I score the rest of the movie just by giving me a four-minute piece of music and a two-minute piece of music. Didn't see the film until long after it came out. But there was a New York City DJ called Lance Weiss. He got the Betamax tape of it, made a recording and of the Heatstroke song, had it burnt to acetate, and played it at the famous Anvil Club in New York. Someone came up to me and said, do you know they're playing your song from that movie at the Anvil? And I said, can't be. I didn't sign it. He said, you've got to go there. He's playing tonight. So I went down to the Anvil, and I'm standing around, and Felipe from the Village People, dressed as an Indian, was on the bar dancing, and you know, other New York City characters and stuff like that. And
yeah.
I went, wow, this place
yeah.
is cool. I kind of like it, you know, kind of a freak show right up my alley. And my song comes on. So I walk up to the DJ booth, and I said, hi, I remember very distinctly climbing up the little wooden stairs, looking over to the DJ booth and seeing the vinyl turning and the needle down and hearing my song, and my heart dropped. I thought, oh, somebody stole my music. This is terrible. And I said to him, I said, excuse me. I said, that's my music. He says, what? And I said, that's my music from the Heatstroke record. Somebody told me you were playing it. He goes, I got to get your number. There's a record company, and they're dying to find out who did this song.
I'll be darned.
And the next day, I went up there and signed my life away on a half-page, one-paragraph thing. I was a 22-year-old kid. And the guy said, do you have any other music? And I said, well, I have some experimental music. I have a song called Man-Made and this hip-hop bebop. I just spit out the words, hip-hop bebop, because I know hip-hop in those days wasn't used. It was rap music. But hip-hop is a jazz term for dancing. Hip-hop bebop, you know, dance to the jazz music, don't stop. So I said, I have this song called, and my brain just said, hip-hop, bebop, don't stop. And he said, I'd like to hear it. So we wound up developing it a little bit more. We put some dog barks on it, and basically ran the tape from beginning to end. There was no structure, and it was all put together in the mix. We did about 30 different mixes, and in those days it was splicing with a razor. We sat there and spliced the song together, and we tried to make some sense out of it over a weekend. And I remember when they put it out, I was embarrassed. I said, this isn't a song. There's no chorus, there's no verse, there's no structure. I want to be a pop star. I didn't want to be a musical, unknown. I said, nothing's ever going to happen with this. I had a huge fight. Well, the record started taking on its own life because it just sounded very unique. The dog box in there were a reference to a club in New York City called the Fun House. And at the Fun House, there was a DJ called John Jellybean Benitez, and there was a girl that used to hang around with him with long black hair. This was before the Studio 54 thing, and her name was Madonna. And she kind of was a nobody, but she had a T-shirt that said, "I'm Madonna." And,
yes, yes.
We used to bring records to him, and he would play them. And if the crowd liked the music, they would bark. If they didn't like the music, they would boo. You know, unlike today when they just stand there with their arms crossed staring at you.
Yes, 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 with that terrible frown on their faces.
Yeah, very good feedback. So we thought we would put dog barking in the record, kind of referencing back to them what they were giving to the DJ. It was kind of a reversal, and no one had done that before. So, of course, those kids loved the record because, oh, it's that record, the dog barking, and we dog barked, you know, whoo, 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 which Arsenio Hall later picked up and did. So
that's where he got it.
On those grounds. And at that time, Disconet put out all these DJ mixes, and I started to do my album. It was at a studio in New York called Vanguard Studios, which is part of Vanguard Records, a jazz label. But everybody used the studio. When other studios were $100, $150 an hour, this was $25 an hour. The record label had this huge studio space, and jazz was on its decline then. And they would rent it to anybody just to pay the rent. So when I would go to the studio, before me would be Arthur Baker and John Robey doing Planet Rock. And after, when I was ending, I had to get out because the kids who did Freeze, A-E-I-O-U, were behind them. And, you know, we'd walk in and Shannon would be singing Gimme Tonight. And I worked indirectly on the Alicia records back then, those old club records, because I had samplers, I had synthesizers and drum machines that most of these people didn't have. Arthur Baker had a drum machine, synthesizers, I did, and one or two other people, John Robey, had synthesizers and samplers. So we would either, they'd either ask to rent our equipment or borrow our equipment, and again, it was extended family. You just lent your $2,000 synthesizer to somebody and go pick it up 2 days later, because that's what people did for each other. So, you know, we wound up directly or indirectly playing on a whole bunch of records back then. It was like a, little New York Motown. You know,
I see. Well, where I would like for the listeners to be able to hear a couple of your earlier tracks, if we can get to Hip Hop Bebop and also Heatstroke. And I also certainly don't want to miss some of the newer stuff. I understand there's another wave of electro fans coming along, and that you're enjoying a new popularity.
The electro stuff picked up really big in the UK, and when that happened, a lot of people started asking questions, you know, where's electro from? And of course, Kraftwerk became a big thing over in Europe. And I was one of the first people not to put out a synthesized record, but to put out a full album that was American-based, that wasn't, Europe-based, because there was there were groups in New York like Suicide and these esoteric kind of groups, but their music was not as structured for an American palette, so to speak. You know, I had Heatstroke going on in the gay clubs. I had hip-hop bebop in the hip-hop clubs, and I had a song called Man Made in the New Wave Club. So just, I mean...
Wow.
You know,
really.
I was oblivious to all this. The record company kept all this from behind me. I wound up at that time, 2.5 million records. To date, 3.5 million records, and I never got paid on a penny for any of that stuff that I did, because it was that classic story, sign here, kid, and the guy bought a plane and a Porsche and a beautiful house and... you know, did all these wonderful things and just said, you know, keep singing, kid, you'll make me a lot of money. So,
Have you to this day been paid for any of those huge hits?
I'm in a lawsuit actually right now with Unidisc Records out of Canada because I...
So Canadians have bought the rights to it?
In those days, the owner of the record label, just from partying so hard, was one of the first people to come down with... like Klaus Nomi with HIV, but in those days it wasn't called HIV, it was called GRID, which is gay-related immune deficiency, and they gave you penicillin, and when you visit people in the hospital, you wore a gown and a mask, because they didn't know if it was airborne. It was very, very early stages, and he used to take my records and put little bags of coke and send it out to the radio stations. And I found all this stuff later, like years later, but he put little party drugs in there and $100 bills and... you know,
my Lord.
DJs and Billboard reporters and stuff to play my record. But in those days, New York City radio was KTU. There wasn't a lot of dance radio, and I didn't have the kind of money where I could go to big clubs. I went to the States a couple of times. I went to these other clubs that I got in for free, but some of the discos weren't really established that much then. And a lot of the clubs I couldn't afford to go into. I was unaware, other than occasionally picking up a Billboard magazine and seeing myself on the dance charts, how the records were doing. So all that was kept from me. You know what I mean? Later on, kids went back to their history and wanted to know, what's the history of a drum machine? We know synthesizers and electronic bands like Erasure were happening in the 80s and stuff like that. So a lot of kids kind of got real turned on to my sound. I get all this, you're the godfather of music and you're a legend, and this is a polite way of saying you're an old man at this point.
Well, your music is still considered to be absolutely classic and definitive versions. So the story they were giving you is that production costs are so high that there's not enough return for us to...
No, what I get was the story was, it takes several months. We put out a record, and it takes 6 months to get paid from a distributor. It's usually 90 days. And then after that 6 months, we have to pay through some production costs. I didn't get an advance. I didn't get anything out of that. The whole recording cost, most of it was done in my house. So we just did some sweetening and mixed it down. if they spent $3,000 putting that album together, maybe. And then he says, well, and after that, you know, we have to do our accounting, and it takes 6 months to maybe a year when you get paid, but that's normal. Don't worry about it, kid. Go out and do a couple of shows. You can make maybe $1,000 doing a show. And
my
go
Lord.
Out and do a show, and I'd have dry ice machines and balloons and pyrotechnics, and I'd spend like $900 on the show and walk away with $100. So people's mouths were hanging open. You know, we had glitter and makeup, and we would get go down to Soho and get Tanzai Yamamoto and some of these really cool designers. We'd walk in and say, we have a record, we want to feature your stuff on stage, it's unique, and they would lend us clothes, and we would put on these spectacles in these new wave clubs and in these hip-hop clubs and rock and roll clubs where, in those days, you know, it was called rap, it wasn't called hip-hop, so you'd have guys in Adidas track suits and Kangol hats and sneakers, and we came out in skirts and graffiti jackets and, you know, glitter spraying all over the place and 3 foot balloons. We'd love to blow up these giant balloons and fill them with glitter. And some jerk in the audience would always be mean and try to pop it with their cigarette. And at the end of the night, you'd see one person leaving that was completely doused in glitter. And you knew they were the person that broke the balloon, you know what I mean? Because they were being mean. But it was quite a spectacle, you know, when we look back on it. It was
well,
fun.
Man, was if hip-hop bebop was very popular in the hip-hop clubs and the heat stroke was running along in the gay clubs, you said there was a third track also that was popular at the same time?
It was a so-called Man-Made, and they played that in the New Wave clubs. It was Kraftwerk-ish. You see,
so you had three records running at the same time and radically different.
I didn't know that until all this came by way later. One of the people who worked for the record company wound up working for me for one of my parties, and he goes, you don't know me, but I used to work for the record company. I was one of the guys started out as a single person and wound up, you know, hiring like 12 or 14 people. And he said, I used to work for the record company, and, you know, you're quite a legend. I said, what are you talking about? I didn't sell that many records. He goes, are you kidding me? I said, they never paid me. I just figured I never made any money. He goes, let me sit down and tell you what's going on. He said, you know, this was in the 90s. He said, you sold 2.5 million records, and, you know, you funded, you know, his lavish lifestyle in our office for years and years to come. And after the guy died, his second right-hand man put a key in the door and kept the business running. The guy had a coke problem and sold off catalog for $1,000 here and there to go buy coke and party all weekend. And
my stars.
Went out the door with everybody else's. In those days.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Well, it'll be resolved now. I mean, you know, things. You know, I believe in, you know, the good of the universe and all that kind of hokey stuff, so things will but in those days, Canada was a separate country, so you could take stuff, go to Canada, mass produce it, steal it, and then bring it back in as imports. It wasn't like today where it's terrorism, where they look through every box to see if there's a bomb and stuff. You could ship, manufacture it out in Canada and bring it back into America, and no one, you know, it was an import record, and no one questioned it. And sometimes even the record labels didn't know whether they licensed it out to other countries. And some countries in Mexico and Canada, they would go get the latest, whoever was, you know, the latest Boy George record and mass duplicate it and bring it back into the country, and no one would go after them. Well, when NAFTA came around,
Lord have mercy,
the trade agreement, all of a sudden there was no border between Canada and America. So if you bought a contract in the U.S., you also bought all the baggage with it, and you bought all the responsibility. So this particular company couldn't hide behind the border anymore. And, I didn't know that we would sold records, and I figured there were a couple of licenses here and there, but I was probably one of those one-hit disco wonders that, you know, sold 10,000 copies, and it would probably cost me $50,000. I got advice from somebody, and they said it cost you $50,000 just to find out that they have a double set of books, and you'll make $10,000 back. Until it headed to Sony PlayStation, until it went into the movies, and I did some searching on the internet, and there were 70, 80 licenses out of there at $5,000 and $10,000 a piece.
Wow.
Including the royalties, and the movie licenses are $40,000-$50,000, and the video game licenses, they sold 44 million copies of Grand Theft Auto. You know? And I didn't receive a penny. So, things have changed over the years from being screwed. I left high school very early. I went to high school performing arts where the movie Fame was, and it was very much like the movie. I worked at the Metropolitan Opera House as a spear carrier and an extra on stage for $10 a scene, and I did that for a couple of years to make some money. But yeah, I have quite a great book that's going to, one of these days,
I bet. Well, Matt, I'd love for the listeners, many of the listeners, we have a diverse audience. We have many straight listeners who are progressive, of course, but who listen to the show, and we have the LGBT folks.
Hey,
exactly, and we have the whole DJ crowd, whatever they are, and we've got.
So
I'd like to share with them. Many have heard it, but I'd like to share with them the hip hop bebop. Glenn did an edit.
Did you
for
say
us.
Share or scare?
I would like to share, absolutely share. This, my friends, is the track that is being used in Grand Theft Auto. Isn't that a Microsoft product, man?
No.
Or is it one of the others?
It's built by it, and then there's a company called Rockstar Games, and they're now rivaling Hollywood in some of their incomes on some of these toys and products.
Amazing, amazing. Well, Bob, if you would roll the hip-hop bebop track, and I'd like the folks to hear one of his very early, and this was a major crossover hit.
This was 1983, by the way. This was before computers and before MIDI. We would have to stop the tape recorder every so many bars, and I'd have to hand punch in drum beats. And like two flashing lights, I would start the drum machine and run for 8 bars. It would run out of sync with the rest of the track. We'd rewind it 4 bars and then punch it back in and go another 12 bars, and it would run out of sync. And we'd do this for the length of a
labor of love.
When we got in line, it was really, it wasn't push-button synthesizer with a computer like people have GarageBand and those sort of things today. This was truly a labor of love.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a moment to share that with the listeners. Bob, if you'd run the hip-hop bebop track. Thanks, Bob. Al, man, you know, to hear the story of how much went into producing that music and actually creating that, it really changes your perspective.
That's actually a remix that was done about 10 years later. There's some additional newer technology, like there's some samples on there, and that ducky kind of bass line, there was a sister unit to the 808 drum machine, which was a 303 bass line, so you could have bass and drums happening while you practice your guitar or piano parts in that little now famous acid techno kind of wah-wah-wah-wah. This mix is about 10 years later. The earlier mix is much simpler, but you can hear in the tracks there's points where it just breaks down to this very empty kind of thing. And in those days when you were in big clubs, people ask me, you know, how do I mix records? And I tell them that the silence between the records is just as much important as the noise that's filling it. So Hip Hop Bebop is just an example of sometimes how I do music. Sometimes silence or the empty space or doing minimal kind of things with just a lot of empty space around it is just as important. And in those days, you know, you had Dan Hartman Records and Donna Summer Records and all that kind of stuff, and out came this instrumental weird track that didn't sound like anything else. So
very interesting.
That's the bit. Yeah, this has a lot of overdubs. It's a lot different than the other one. But as you can hear, there's no structure to the song. There's no chorus and verse and break, and there's no hook. It's kind of like a montage of sound that kind of just kind of somehow or another works to my and everybody else's surprise. I'm also a perfectionist, so I don't like my own music. And it's a good thing for me because it keeps me alive and it keeps me always wanting to do something else.
Well, speaking of doing something else, there's a hot rumor out these days that you're about to do a project with Ernest Cole. Is that true?
What I'm doing is I'm doing a couple of other people. We approached Andy Bell from Erasure and Pete Burns from Dead or Alive. I am doing a 80s album of songs like Yazoo Situation. Ernest has a very high, very nice voice, and I did a remake of Never Ending Story, you know, which I personally love. You know, it's my little happy song from back then.
It's a great track. Yeah,
it's a great track, and I just redid it. I did Situation, another one, Bites the Dust. Songs that I like, basically. You know, when Linda Ronstadt does the All American Songbook, I'm doing my version, which is the 80s, and it's all synthesized. So Ernest's voice, when he sings up in the higher registers, it's nice and smooth and silky. And Ernest approached me to remix one of his tracks off of some new stuff he's doing, and I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll remix a track for you if you sing one for me, because I know his voice and I know Ernest for years." And I said, "You know, we won't pay or sue each other. You know, if someone has a hit record, go ahead and enjoy." So handshake, and Ernest got the track a couple of days ago, and I have total faith that he'll do something really great with it. You know.
Yeah, Ernest is a great guy. He's been on the show a couple of times and brought some wonderful guests with him. Regarding Heatstroke, I'm holding in my hand a article from eMusic, and this particular article is actually reviewing music from porn soundtracks, and I was floored when I saw that. Who knew? Apparently the author is saying that his favorite piece of genuinely awesome porn soundtrack music was Heatstroke, but yet in the beginning, is this the one that the DJ lifted and was playing somewhere else?
Joe Gage used to put out these they weren't full hardcore gay porn. He was kind of a gay and bisexual kind of guy, so it wasn't like gay porn is today with some of the crazy stuff that goes on. His porns were more like a lot of heavy cruising, a lot of eye staring. It was almost like watching a Lita Wertmuller film, you know, and they Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was like, you know, someone was staring at another guy, and the guy was staring back him, and they would cut to the third guy staring at the first guy who was looking at the second guy, and I'm like, you know, where's the good stuff, folks? You know what I mean? But in those days, it was all about the story, I guess. And this was, Heatstroke was from that. So
So you wrote the beginning of Heatstroke was used throughout the movie, and then when everybody loved that.
I did about an hour and a half worth of music. Heatstroke was a 8 or 10 or 12 minute piece that was in the beginning of it, but there's a lot of ambient music that I did for that, Vangelis kind of music that I did for that kind of stuff. A lot of the sound sculptures and stuff like that that wound up in the movie. So there's an electronic film score to that, you know. All that stuff is gone now. That was on half-inch sound-on-sound or four-track tape and stuff, and most of that stuff is gone. I've got to go find a copy of it and listen to it, you know. I didn't score to the movie. He just said, give me 4 minutes here, 2 minutes there. And I did what I knew I could do. You know, I just made some sounds. He said, I want this one up-tempo and this one dark and this one moody and this one, they're running.
and they loved the riff. The riff was so popular, then you expanded it into Heatstroke and added the lyrics, and it became a concept. Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, what happened is... He played the song that he played at the Anvil, the DJ, was not the complete song that wound up on the album.
Yes, that's what I'm getting at. I was trying to understand how that worked.
Right. The one in the movie and the one there was the 8-track version, and then we upped it to 24-track. I carried my machine in a taxi cab and put up the big 15-inch reels of half-inch tape, and we put it to the first 8 tracks of a 24-track, and they hired these girls called the Rain Sisters. And one of them kept going to the bathroom to shoot up heroin. We didn't even know she kept coming out.
The other two girls
had picked them back up again. I'm like, who are these girls? And they're like, great voices. Who cares? And, you know, funny, the guy who did the vocal arrangement on that song is Mark Shaman and Scott Whitman. They did Hairspray, amongst a couple of other big things, and they were the musical director, and Mark Shaman was, and Scott Whitman was the guy who did all of Bette Midler's jokes back in the day, and they were part of the New York community, and I just said, hey, Mark, you're the piano player. Can you hook up some vocal arrangements, you know what I mean? So a little bit of disco trivia in there. And then we had Johnson, who is a well-known session player, now an artist of his own, right? He was a percussionist, and he came in and laid all the percussion down on that. So the track kind of grew into this. At that day, I would have called it Saint, the Saint in New York City, the big, huge dome, famous club. It was a giant planetarium dome, and you would dance underneath the dome with the stars and all the lights.
I heard about that place recently. Someone was telling me about it. Quite
an incredible experience. You would walk into, it was the Fillmore East, and you would walk in, the whole place was painted black, which was very unusual in those days, and there were little pin spot lights. And you went to this cage, and they were one of those dry cleaner things where you check your check your jacket, and you would give it a number, and it would go up on the dry cleaner rack up into the ceiling somewhere. You head down. There's a beautiful. The walls were black. There were bleachers, and just a big pin spot in the center, and these beautiful flowers. And you hear this disco boom, boom, boom coming from above your head. You go up these kind of fire escape stairs, and you go through a curved doorway, and you're in this giant, massive planetarium dome that it was 3 or 4 stories high, and you know, massive circumference, and there were no lights inside the dome hanging from the ceiling. They were on a center, they called it the tree, but a pole in the center with all these lights, and they would there was a projector, the planetarium projector that projected stars, and the top of the dome would open up, and a disco ball would come down, which Grace Jones rode down for New Year's, and this time wide open, and a stage would be there, and they would do shows. A good friend of mine that you had on a couple of weeks ago, Paul Parker, used to play there. And in fact, I remember one night I went with Paul. I think Paul was singing or Ernest was singing, and it was me, Paul Parker, Ernest Cole was there, and Dan Hartman. And I was like,
I'll be darned.
Yeah. So it was quite the place. It was quite the place for a couple of years. So Heatstroke was then turned into a Saint record, so those type of DJs and Disconet, the remix service, could extend it and send it out to these type of clubs. So that song was geared from electronic. Giorgio Moroder kind of synthesized the song into more of a commercial song with percussion in it, so it could be worked through the market. You know, that was deliberately done that way, whereas the other ones are more experimental.
Right. Well, I'd love for the listeners to get a chance to hear that. Now, the heat stroke was out about the same as hip hop, but the heat stroke was very popular in the gay clubs, and especially
it was popular in the gay clubs. Yeah, and you probably just want to play a couple of seconds or you know a minute of it because it's quite a long song. You don't want to go.
It's been edited forward. Down. I don't recall if it says edit, so I know it's been reduced. But I'll have Bob go ahead.
3 minutes and just play a couple of, you know, play a minute or two.
We'll do just that. We'll have Bob fade it after the first chorus. Go ahead and roll it, Bob. Heat stroke. Okay, there we go. Wanted to be sure.
Yeah, give you a little history on that.
Yes, please.
In those days, I was, first of all, that robot type of voice is a thing called a vocoder. It's what crap some other people used. I bought my vocoder. That was what Electric Light Orchestra used. They sold this to a music store on 48th Street in Manhattan, and I walked in, and the guy said, oh, I don't know what it is. You want it? Give me $50. And it turned out, I'm not a singer, it turned out to be my quote-unquote voice on my records later on.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
How that idea came about.
Yeah, I'm not a singer, and I knew Kraftwerk had used vocoders, and I was a Kraftwerk freak. And that particular song, Heatstroke, I loved Patrick Kelly, and I loved all of his stuff, Lift Off and all those kind of songs, and I tried to emulate his songs and his chord changes with Heatstroke. It sounds a little bit like it. Marty Blechman, who had Megatone Records, had later contacted me after Patrick Cowley passed away and wanted me to do music for Sylvester because I was the most similar sound to, in those days, to what Patrick Cowley would do. I wound up giving him some tracks. Sylvester hated it, but I wound up meeting Paul Parker and becoming lifelong friends with him. You know what I mean? So that's the history on that record.
Well, I've heard some of the DJs actually say that you picked up where Patrick Cowley left off. We lost him, of course, to AIDS.
I was in love with his music. And through Paul, I'm a bit of a gear whore. And through Paul, I have Donna Summer's sequencer. I have Electric Light Orchestra's vocoder. And I have Patrick Cowley's synthesizer, the main one that he did.
I'll be darned.
They wound up giving it to Paul Parker, and he said, there's this thing in the closet. Do you want it? And I was like, oh, my God, yes. disco history, of course, you know. And,
of course, yes.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me, you know, that just to come across. Someone in chat is pointing out that it may have been the vocoder that ELO used for Mr. Blue Sky.
It is the exact one that, thank you very much for noticing it. It was the one that they used for Mr. Blue Sky. When you work with a vocoder, if anybody is a producer out there, I'll give you a little hint. When I sang the words "pocket full of money" and "I'm going to town," most people normally sing like that for a vocoder. But if you want your vocoder clear, I call it, you have to speak vocoder ease. So I say "pocket full of money" and "I'm going to town." And filters. If you heard me compared to what you heard there, you know, if you're sitting in the room, you go, "This guy's nuts." But what you learned how to play, like a guitar player would learn how to play a guitar, you would learn how to use the instrument.
I'll be damned.
And get clarity out of it, because a lot of vocoders, even Mr. Blue Sky, is a little mumbly. It was good and clear, but you'd have to listen. And it drove me crazy. I wanted vocoders to be crisp and clear and almost human-like in voice, which the technology has now, but back then didn't. So you have to learn how to work a vocoder. And people say, how come your vocoder is always clear? And I said, that's because I talk like that on the vocoder. And it forces the filters to open and close, you know, more efficiently and stuff like that. Yeah.
I'll be darned. Well, man, I'd love for you to pick out and introduce the next track. We have so many to choose from. In fact, you even... Glenn and I came up with what we could, and then you sent in a couple today. Those are probably special ones to you to include them.
Randy Jones is a friend of mine from obviously working with Village People. I got involved with them. They wanted me to produce a record for Australia. And, of course, I had had the Male Stripper record out, which was number one throughout the world. At that time, high-energy music was not very popular in the U.S., but it was huge with Stock Aitken Waterman around the world. It was a big pop sound. And those people traveled the world, and Randy, very smart, knew that sound, called me up and said, we'd love for you to do a song for us for Australia for Village People. And I was like, oh, you Village People, you got to be kidding me, you know. I'm too fabulous for Village People, you know, what a joke. And he said, well, we're playing out this club in Brooklyn called Spectrums, and that's where they did Saturday Night Fever. What? It's a gay club now. Why don't you come down and just see the guys? And I was like, oh, okay. And I was kind of blown away. They did their live vocals, and, you know, they were disco war veterans, and they'd been on the road, and they had their show together and all that. And I said, okay, I'll do it. It would be great to add to the resume. I have Boy George and Gloria Gaynor and, you know, all these people that I work with, the Michael Jackson remix. And I'm sure Village People, you know, get me another job somewhere. And I love the guys, and we wound up touring through Australia and stuff like that, and I wound up being with them for 6 years on the road. We went every place from Reykjavik, Iceland to Australia, from Japan, you know, all the way, everywhere. We wake up the next day and wouldn't know what city are we in, you know what I mean? But it really got like that after a while. So Randy and I stayed friends over the years. Randy did a remake of Pet Shop Boys, New York City Boy. And
yeah. I've heard the song. It's a great track.
Yeah, he said, I said, Randy, I love you. Of course, you know, in a second, I would love to do a remix. So this is Randy singing, and I stripped the track down for the Bare Nothing and rebuilt the whole track underneath it. He wanted that Giorgio Moroder kind of sound, and I did, and I got a little grandiose with choir and all that kind of stuff in the background. This is all stuff done with computer. Most of it's done on my Macintosh laptop, which are strong enough now. You know, and I can get 48 or 64 tracks of digital audio. The synthesizers are virtual. The old patch cord synthesizers are sitting there collecting dust, and these are little, not little, but rather complicated plugins, and the computer is doing all the computational power. It's computing the drum sounds. It's computing the synthesizer sounds, the filter sounds. It's doing the mixing. It's computing the reverb times and the delay lines and playing back Randy's voice all in sync. So we've come a long way, baby. You know, so, New York City Boy, Randy Jones, if you have it, it'd be great.
That sounds great. Yes, we do have it, and Bob hit it. That would be Randy Jones, Man Parrish, New York City Boy. Absolutely amazing stuff. You know,
that song actually came to me. Randy did the track, and it was a demo that he did. He asked me to remix it. That was actually mixed on an airplane between New York and actually coming back from L.A. There's stuff in music called MIDI. Some people may know that. It's the notes. It's the computer. It's the digital representation of the notes. Remember I told you a while ago each note had a value and a time signature and all that.
He gave me a
file, which is almost like a word processing file that his arranger did. And then I sat on the plane with his vocal and pulled it all together and did some overdubs, sitting on the plane with a pair of headphones, flying back to my friend's house in L.A., and I completely constructed that, mixed it down, and finalized it within, what was it, cross-country flight, 4 or 5 hours or something like that. I just sat there on my little tray table, and that's the power of music and how things have drastically changed from the old days.
Wow, to be sitting on a plane and able to produce that, that's just amazing. There are several questions for you. One of our chatters goes by the name ELO, by the way. She's a huge ELO fan. She wants to be sure. She's checking with you. Do you actually still physically have ELO's old vocoder?
Yes. It is called, let me go take a look right here. It is the EMS Vocoder 2000. EMS Vocoder 2000. And you can, they also made a 5000, but you could look up online. It's there's a lot of, gear heads that have, stuff on it, and it's still considered a great vocoder. My vocoder, unfortunately, hasn't been used in 15 years, and I'm afraid if I turn it on, it'll either blow up, or if I turn a knob, it'll fall off in my hand. It's in a terrible state of disrepair.
Well, I'll tell you, if you have a small digital camera, if you'd send me a picture of that vocoder sometime, I'm sure it would make ELO's day, absolutely,
if you go to manparish.com, there's photos of all the equipment that's in my studio under my gear page. There must be, I have, several hundred synthesizers and stomp boxes and processing gears and stuff like that. So if you go to my page, there is photos of, and the ones I couldn't find, didn't have pictures of, I would pull off a website, but it's the same thing. So you could see a list of all my gear. Now, the stuff that I used for this particular track, there is no real physical keyboard. That's all being computed by the computer as a plug-in. So, I pulled up a virtual synthesizer, and it has the same kind of interface as a real synthesizer, tuned in the bass sounds, tuned in the string sounds, and threw in a couple of drum loops and made some drum patterns and stuff like that. So that's just now is a new and different way of working than what she's talking about, when even the vocoder is an actual plugin that works within Apple Logic, which is the actual computer program that I use to make music, which many people use.
Well, you also have an email from Ernest Cole, and if you'll recall earlier, you were joking that you hoped Ernest wasn't going to sue you. He absolutely guarantees that he is not going to sue you. It has kind words.
I won't sue him either.
We also have it.
I won't sue.
Okay, I'm sure he's relieved to hear that. We also have an email from one of our DJ friends, Hank Steinhauer. Hank actually participates in our gig bar across the street. He is saying that it's a great show, and he'd like to hear about the Zone Brothers.
All right, Paul and Mickey, and there was an Armand Zone. There were four boys. It was an Italian family in my neighborhood. Three boys and two girls, and they all turned out gay. The Italian mother almost slit her wrist. Paul had a group called The Fast, F-A-S-T, in New York, and they played some of the places like CBGB's and Max's Kansas City, those kind of New York City legendary rock and roll clubs. And part of the extended family, we knew Paul. I used to hang out in these clubs, and Deborah Harry was the bartender, and she would get up and do Blondie. I saw Aerosmith come down in a van and play on stage, and then they would hang outside trying to get laid. I saw Joan Jett when she was in the Runaways. We saw Bruce Springsteen get booed off the stage. I remember David Bowie and Brian Eno presented a new group called Devo, and it was their first time in New York where they ever played. So the Runaways, the Talking Heads, I could go on and on and on, through all these groups. But Paul's Own was one of the local bands, and I was friends with them. And later on, Paul, when High Energy Music came out, Mickey, Paul's brother, decided to do some dance music. And I was the guy with the synthesizer in the studio, and they, hey, you know, can we come in your studio? We can only pay you $50, but, you know, can we do Male Stripper? Can we do Cuba? Can we do, you know, Energy is Eurobeat and all these songs that we did? And we would knock them out in 4 or 5 hours or something like that, 6 hours, and they would take the stuff away, and I'd make $50 and buy some food that night, and, you know, they would go get a couple $100 together and press the records and kind of sell them. So Paul's Own, his name is Cilioni, or Cilioni or something like that, and his brother Mickey, again, was one of the first casualties with HIV. His brother passed away, and then Paul and Claudio now have Man to Man, and then it became Man to Man became, I can't remember the other, they changed the name twice, and I don't know what he's recording under now. He occasionally puts out a record here or there. I can't remember the name that he changed it to, but that's the poll. They were neighbors of mine, you know, in my neighborhood in Brooklyn.
I see. That's interesting that Hank would know about that. Hank spent some time up in the, in fact, used to play up in the New York area. He is in Miami now, and he often tells us interesting stories about the New York area. He also is requesting, by the way, to hear Man to Man Male Stripper remix.
Great. We
could play a bit of that.
It's around the world. We did Top of the Pops, and we had the background singers that were actually Go-Go Boys. And the English are very uptight and have a lot of heavy rules about TV because it was government run. And the guys opened their shirts and sort of peeled it off their shoulder. We got banned from the BBC, and they almost pulled the plug on the air for us because that was the most scandalous thing. Their switchboards lit up, and it was all these little English moms were going crazy that men were stripping, and of course the kids were loving it. And the fact that we got banned off the BBC shot the record up to number one. So,
that's fabulous.
The radio wouldn't play it, but all the pirate radio stations played it, and all the underground stations and all the DJs immediately picked it up.
That's fabulous. Well, we have the remix that we happen to have available here was remixed by Angel Disco, and we have an edit of Man to Man Male Stripper. Roll it, Bob.
Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen.
Adonis, working after hours, ripples on my chest, never got a night's rest. A modern day jack, a jock with an act. Halo leader, touch me, squeeze me, ooh.
I want to say we weren't writing a Puccini opera here. I just want everybody to know that.
We did have a sense of humor. It was actually, it's fabulous. I should point out to the listeners, though, this was probably an unauthorized remix. I don't know if
Angel... Yeah, it's the longest intro I've ever heard in my life. I mean,
I knew you were thinking that.
Paul's brother used to like, you know, male strippers and crazy lifestyle and stuff. He says, I'm going to do a male stripper song. I was like, okay, that's great. And it came down to that call, that little percussion break where they go, strip for me and strip for you. I had a sampler. We stole that drum loop out of Miami Sound Machine's Conga. Come on, baby, let's do that Conga. And that's a little 2 or 4 bar loop that I stole with my sampler because we needed percussion. And they said, well, what should we sing over here? And I said, oh, I don't know. Strip for me, I'll strip for you. And he goes, great. And I said, no, I was only kidding. Please don't sing that. And sure enough, they did. So I was my back. Recording, they were there with a microphone crammed into my little bedroom, and I'm just cringing, going, oh, weird, this is going to happen. So they put the record out, and Paul put my name on it because I had a hit record in England with hip hop, bebop, and all that kind of stuff. And we did it for $50. The record went away, and about a year and a half later, somebody called me and said, You have a record on the pop charts in England. And I said, no, I don't. I haven't put out a record in a while. He goes, yeah, some male stripper song. I said, male stripper by him. And they said, man to man, meet man parish. And I went, you never did a male stripper song. I mean, it was like one of these things I did in 5 hours and forgot about the next day. You know what I mean? And sure enough, it was so campy. It took off. And even to this day, I have a bunch of, Chippendales guys that come up to me and go, yo, dude, if it wasn't for your male stripper song, I couldn't have gotten through some of those nights. I always dance with ladies and strip to your song. And I'm like, oh, this is what I wanted to do in life.
So, and you facilitated that.
We weren't writing a Puccini opera here, folks. You know, it was a tongue-in-cheek, campy record. You know, not all music is serious. Sometimes we like to have fun. I need a little pressure valve release, and I am pretty twisted, so, you know.
It is great fun. I should tell you that the chat room is Googling your pictures and posting links and saying that you are hot, hot, hot.
Those are the old publicity photos that we like to do. I'm 6 foot tall, 6'3", and I'm going to hit my 50th birthday, and, I'm on the chucky side, you know, if you like full-bodied guys, you know, maybe have a little face left, but the belly's definitely gone to the middle age, you know, slump kind of stuff. But,
well, being 55, I could...
Thank you.
Also, VJC, this is Victor from Disco 935 in New York. He's saying, what's up? And he says, New York in the house, I have all his shit. Meaning he plays
please.
You off.
I'm definitely a New York based kind of guy. I've done well over in Europe and stuff like that. But I grew up in New York City. I'm a New York City boy. I left home at 14 and, you know, lived at the YMCA and slept on people's couches and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I definitely came up through the club scene. And
yes, and you came through a lot, and you made it.
Yeah, it's my bass, it's my sound. You can hear from the old tracks to the new tracks, obviously. I've learned a lot and learned how to program and learned a lot more about music, and my tastes in music have changed and all that kind of stuff. They say you can tell a lot of people about a lot of people what's on their iPod, and I have an iPhone, of course, because I'm a geek and a gear whore, but I have dance music, but I also have my ambient music, too, which it takes the stress off of me. Since I don't pop Valium and I don't smoke weed anymore, I just put on my headphones and
it would be a wonderful experiment in psychology to dig through your iPod to find out.
I have the craziest stuff, you know. I mean, I have a weird electronic ambient stuff. I'm an armchair Buddhist, so I have Tibetan bowl singing bowl gong music, and it just goes gong gong for 15 or 20 minutes meditation stuff. I have the fiercest Chicago house records of Girl, I'll House You and Marshall Jefferson stuff, so it's quite eclectic. I have the Beatles' Love album, the one that they used for Cirque du Soleil, which is all remixed. If anybody hasn't heard that, it's just amazing to see what they did with those tracks, and they stripped them down and they reconstructed them, and I have electro stuff by, Fisher Spooner and new shit as well as old stuff, you know. So it is quite a classic spot all over the place.
Well, I should put the... it's been a while since I mentioned the phone number. It's my neglect. If you'd like to call in, we have some time left. It's 877, the number 4-HEAD-ON. That's toll-free, 877-4-HEAD-ON. Or if you have unlimited long distance, you can use that. It rings at dials at 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and it rings in West Virginia. Man, we're getting some questions about the track called Man Sugar, Brown Sugar. They're asking if this is...
Okay, let me explain.
Okay.
I wound up, after I left Dead Record Company didn't work, I was signed to Elektra Records, managed by David Bowie's manager. They were doing a showcase for a girl. They were trying to sign the president of Elektra Records, Bob Krasnow, and his son came down, and they completely walked past her, came over to me and said, "We want to sign you." And this is David Bowie's manager going, "Well, this girl, Sandy Dillon, she's the next Janis Joplin." And they're like, "I don't give a damn. We want Man Paris." So I signed this record deal. It didn't work out, you know what I mean? We went through a lot of money and didn't produce any records. And another one of those mistakes that I made as a kid, just signing along a piece of paper. I wound up on Select Records in New York, which was a hip-hop label. They had... it was urban in those days, a rap label. They had UTFO and they had that Roxanne song and a lot of that New York street kind of sound. The owner was a white guy putting out all black music, but he kind of understood me. He knew I was very quirky. He said, "Just do a record and you can do whatever you want." I said, "I like Brown Sugar, the Rolling Stones. You know, I have this very wide taste of music. I'd love to do a sample-based version, you know, with samplers and just kind of stretch my creative wings a little bit." So we did Brown Sugar. I did all the vocals,
including the girl voice
on the stuff.
Priceless.
I was in the studio with my friend, and you know, I said, "Push play and record. You know, hit the record button."
Brown Sugar,
and he just started cracking up, and I started cracking up, and we were rolling around on the floor, and I had to get a serious face. He says, "Do it, do it. It's crazy. Do it. It's so weird." And it's one of those things that I just wish I didn't do, but it's so quirky now that it's brilliant. But back then it was like, "Oh my God!" I remember playing it for the record company, and you know, he looked at me and he goes, "You're not serious." I said, "No, I'm not serious." And then he started laughing and said, "We'll put it out." So that's Brown Sugar with all crazy vocals on it.
Well, we do have the 12-inch vocal. Is it all right if we run that? There's a lot of curiosity about that track.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you could fast forward through these things and just play little snippets of it, because some of these have dance mixes for dance floors, and you know, I'm sure people don't want to sit through 2 minutes.
I understand.
I mean, we'll just, if you don't mind, and you can pull them out a lot earlier if you want, but
I understand. We'll run Brown Sugar from the beginning, and we'll fade early after we hear the girl voice. We've got to hear the girl voice, then we'll be satisfied.
Yeah.
Okay.
That came out of a funny thing. I had this crazy girlfriend, and she was completely wacko, and she used to call up the local gas station over here and try to get the guy to have phone sex with her, and, you know, we were like, juveniles, you know what I mean, 25-year-old, you know, going through a 45th childhood, and she say, I want you to talk to my friend who's here, Sandy, and I'm like, come on, hello, hi, I'm so naked right now, and we'd roll on the floor and laugh and be silly and stuff like that, so that's how that.
You know, New York sounds like an awfully fun place. You know, coming from a rural community in the South, I've always been a little terrified of it, but it just sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, see, in this city, you had permission to be a little kooky and crazy, and a lot of people that didn't fit in elsewhere found safety in numbers. So, you know, if you were a little strange, if you were a little different, if you were a DJ when everybody else worked in a, you know, in a factory, you know, you were the odd man out, either sexually or mentally or creatively or whatever. A lot of people came to New York City because it was just safety in numbers. There are other people like you, and chances are you could find them. So in that sense, it was
amazing.
A fun place, you know, where you could be yourself. You still can. The nightlife here suffered a lot. Obviously, the 9/11 and Giuliani really changed a lot in the city, but you hear that all the time. But there are parts of New York that are still very alive and very well. You just have to search a little bit further underground for it. It's one of the safest cities in America now. You can ride the subway and not get mugged. I live in a very safe neighborhood where, you know, I lock my doors, but a lot of people don't. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you what, man, we need to go ahead, and it's getting near the end. We have a caller waiting for you, and if we're going to run a couple. So let's run the Brown Sugar. We'll fade out of that a little bit early, and we'll take the caller.
Yeah,
go, Bob.
Gold Coast slave ship Alpha Cottonfields, sold at a market town in New Orleans. That scarred old slaver knows he's doing all right. You can hear him with the women just around midnight.
Man, I have an entirely different... You have totally rocked my world. In chat, Glenn Rivera is there. Glenn Rivera is saying he used to love playing this song in the clubs, and he used to loop it, and I was just telling him I would have killed for a copy when I was DJing back in the day in the 80s. And we have VJC on the phone for you. Victor, welcome to the show.
Hey, Victor, how you doing?
How you doing? How you doing, man, Parrish?
Doing good.
Welcome.
Doing good.
I've been listening to the show since 9 o'clock, and I just wanted to chime in because one quick thing. I know the show is about to end. I just feel so bad. Obviously, all your great work from back in the day, you didn't even get paid. I mean, it's just a shame.
I'm not the only person in this industry. Yes, there's a lot of people that have fallen victim. But I'll tell you something, and I do mean this from my heart. It's stuff like this. I just came back from the Winter Music Conference. It's people like you that just come up to me and say, hey, I like your music, I love what you did, or, you know, you did something and it kind of, you know, made me smile or brought back a memory. And although I didn't make any cash on it, in a weird way I got paid in that sense. You know what I mean? When I was 20 years old, I wanted to be a pop star. At 30, it wasn't going to work anymore. But just getting a little bit of recognition or someone shaking your hand and saying, hey, that was kind of cool, that was kind of good, or it reminds me of my childhood. Now it really makes me feel good. So things
exactly.
like doing the show.
Same thing will happen to me. Obviously, I'm a DJ since 1975, and I run Disco 93.5 on the Internet. And it's the same thing that I feel. It's not, it's when people compliment me, even though I'm not getting paid, it's about that. And obviously, like what Glenn Rivera is doing and putting all these artists
on. Glenn is an angel, and, you know, he keeps all the stuff alive. He doesn't get paid for a lot of this stuff, and, you know, but it's, you know, I'm sure people turn around and say, thank you, Glenn. I say thank you, Glenn, and it
right.
really means
and
a lot
the thing
to people.
Is that when I run my station, I pay for all the, you know, I run my own station myself. No one pays me. I have to run my own
sure.
station. And the thing is, like artists like you, I mean, I haven't played as many tracks from you because it's very hard because a lot of people are very finicky because they want to hear more disco stuff. But I say disco is all stuff with beats, and especially what you played, especially it's a lot of the stuff is from Kraftwerk. It's very
cool. Well, because I didn't grow up in the disco era. I entered it a little bit later. I grew up as
a
rock and roller and a new waver that became, you know, into dance music. So I've always retained, you know, that. I kind of like that edge. You know what I mean?
The edge of a little rock in there, a little new wave and a little this and that. Where you innovated. You know, you did your own sound, which was great because, you know...
I wasn't driven by the markets, but I didn't have to do a 4-on-4 dance floor to get my next record out to get
it. Right, but
I
that's what's great about
it. I was able to experiment a little bit more since I didn't know how successful my records were. I just did what I wanted to do, but I did what I thought people would like as opposed to, oh, I really want to do... a broken beat record, but I have to do Fall on the Floor because that's what everybody's doing. So
it was nice to be able to step out of it,
you know?
Right. What was great about you, especially when Man Parrish, I mean, when you did that hip hop bebop, that thing blew me away. I mean, I didn't walk to the store. I ran to the store for that cut.
This is my payback right there. Thank you very, very much. I get
it's just that they don't make the songs like that no more where people run to the store now they download it.
I look at it this way. Go download it because I'm not making a penny off of it. I do sell it off of iTunes and off of my website, which is great. But at this point in my life, I do my DJing. I have a weekly residence in a club, and I travel, and I spend a lot of old school house and a lot of classics. I could spend some...
Okay, guys, it's getting awfully late to the hour. And Victor, love you, Victor. Thank you.
Hey, Parrish, listen, it's been nice talking to you. Hopefully in the future, Peter will have you on the show, and I'll call early.
Great, and if you need to get in touch with me, anybody, manparrish.com, and you can just send me an email, and I read my own email, and I can usually, not right away, but I can get through to people.
Okay, no problem.
Good night, Victor. Yes, sir. Victor is one of our good friends. Also, there was an additional email from Hank, and he was regretting that he could not call, and Hank was the one who asked about the Zone Brothers. And the reason Hank can't call in, you're going to love this, he's playing live in a club right now. That's just hard to wrap your head around, but the guy's done it a long time. Manny,
Hank, I hope you're not DJing MP3s, because if you're on the net at the same time, you might crash your computer, and I don't want to be responsible for that.
Manny, you are an Excellent, excellent guest. Indeed, we have only scratched the surface. We must have you back. Please consider. Okay.
I have some websites online. You can email me. I have an adult site online which I've been running for years. And mymanparish.com has a bunch of history of dance music and hip-hop music and breaking music, and also has a whole bunch of snippets you could listen to and so on. And I'm also on iTunes. And, I hope I...
You're on Amazon, too.
But found interesting.
Wonderful. I just couldn't be happier.
That have been wonderful to me, and to all of us in the dance music, world. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, man, and I couldn't be happier. Good night to you, sir.
Sure.
And, folks, that's going to wrap it up for a Strictly Confidential. John Fox should be joining us shortly, along with myself and Bob Kincaid. Want to let you know that we will have Chantel Pierre coming up Monday live from the United Kingdom, thanks to our dance music talent scout, Mr. Glenn Rivera. And in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.